My name is Susanna Holm, and I'm 39 years old. It's March 19th, 2006, in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I am the daughter of Cecilia Campbell Holm.
My name is Cecilia Campbell Holm. I was born on August 8th, 1931, which makes me 74 years old. It's March 19th of 2006, Flagstaff, Arizona, and I'm with my daughter, Susanna.
My mother was born Cecilia Campbell in 1931, and she's always had a very vivid, detailed memory that goes very far back. And some of her earliest memories were of growing up on an Army post in southern Arizona on Fort Huachuca. Her father was stationed as a regular Army officer there between World War I and World War II. And I've asked her to come back to Arizona, where I live now, to share with me some of the stories about her father and about Fort Huachuca, and to reflect with me on what those stories have meant to her and what they've meant about our family. And the first question I think I'd like to ask is, could you tell me a little bit about what Fort Huachuca looked like?
I can tell you quite a bit about what Fort Huachuca looked like, Susanna. I have, as you said, I have a very detailed memory that goes way back. It's a joke in the family. Fort Huachuca was the 1930s, was very isolated, very self-contained. It was laid out as Army posts were at that time, and probably still are, in a rectangle. On one side of the one of the long sides of the rectangle, there were the officers' quarters. Opposite them were the barracks, the post exchange. At one end, there was the hospital and the officers' club. At the other end were several buildings, one of which was my first school. And in the distance, there was the Arizona desert. It was a very beautiful, beautiful location, but very isolated, very self-contained. And I think that's part of why it's so vivid in my memory. It was a regular Army post. It was part of the segregated Army, segregated by class, by race. There were enlisted officers, enlisted men, officers, and then black troops. We rarely left the post. We took trips to Nogales occasionally and sometimes to Tucson, but it was a very contained life. It was a good life for me as an officer's daughter. I was, five, six, seven, maybe four there. I had a pony. I could walk across the parade ground to my school. I had dancing lessons. It was a very pleasant way to spend those years. It was hard for all of us to leave. In fact, my mother, who came from Maryland, I had thought might feel the desert as being foreign and oppressive, but she told me much later in life that the beauty was just overwhelming.
And what, your father was an officer. What was his relationship to the troops and the enlisted men?
I really was not very much aware of that, certainly with the black troops. They were peripheral to my life. I had one of my best friends, Patty Cooper, was the daughter of an enlisted man, and I never would have realized that, except that one afternoon I was waiting for my father to take me down to Patty's house in the enlisted men's quarters, and apparently the person who was in the room had a question about that, and my father replied, "Why not? He's a hell of a fine fella." And so there was no distinction in our family in that way.
So you lived at Fort Huachuca for a few years, and then your family moved on. But you also, I remember we went back as a family to Fort Huachuca. And can you tell me, it was in the 1970s, what was it like going back?
I was really of two minds about going back. We had been at Christmas at my mother's home in California, and we drove to Tucson and then drove south, and I had known that the base had expanded tremendously. I think there was a Signal Corps there, and I know now it's a center for Army intelligence, and people had told me that it was just huge. It was a wonderful surprise to drive in from Sierra Vista, which was Fry in the days that I was there, to find that the heart of this huge Army establishment was still exactly the same. The officers' quarters had been preserved. The layout, my school was not a school anymore, but I could recognize everything, and I could get the feeling of what it had been like there. It was a wonderful opportunity to share that with my husband and my children.
And it's something of a joke in the family that all of the different places you have lived over the years as you were growing up, somehow they've all managed to survive. So it's not surprising to us that it did. But you were lucky in this case that not only did the post survive, you actually had a conversation a few years later in the 1970s with someone who had been at Fort Huachuca at the same time as your family. Can you tell me a little bit about
that? Yes, that incident is what has precipitated this interview moment. It was a moment out of time, and I felt that it should be preserved, and I certainly have shared it with my children. I was flying again to my mother's house in California. We were flying over the desert, over the Arizona desert. I was sitting next to an older African-American gentleman, and when we began to talk, he told me that he was a retired probation officer from Oakland. He'd been visiting his daughter in Oklahoma, recovering from a stroke. Then we shared a bit of our lives, current lives. We looked down at the desert, and he said, "It's hot down there. You ever been down there?" And I said, "Yes, I spent part of my early childhood in Fort Huachuca, Arizona." And he said, "I was stationed at Fort Huachuca in the 30s. And something made me say, my name was Campbell then. And he turned and looked at me and said, "Was Captain Campbell your daddy?" And I said, "Yes, he was a captain while we were there. He was a major when we moved on." He said to me, "A man was a man to your daddy. He was fair. He treated everybody the same. The guys knew that they might wind up peeling potatoes for a week, but he was fair. They liked him." And there was a little pause, and he said, did your daddy ever tell you about going on maneuvers in Arkansas?" And strangely enough, I had a letter from my father from Arkansas. He had written it on the maneuvers, telling me that his steward was taking good care of him, that he was anxious to get back and to give my mother a kiss. So I said, "Yes, I do know he went on those maneuvers." And he said, "We were in, it was a long train of trucks, dusty and hot, open trucks. We pulled into a gas station, and the people there wouldn't service. They wouldn't service. Your daddy got down and he said to them, 'If these men are good enough to serve their country, they're good for anything you've got in this place.' And they were out there with lemonade, with pop, with ice water." He said, "A man was a man to your daddy." And that has meant a great deal to me over the years. It was a recognition of something that I dimly had realized about my father. He was fair. He was a patriot. He was conservative, but he held some really deep beliefs about the value of all people.
Can you tell me a little bit about where your father came from, or and where you think he might have gotten those values?
He was born in Omaha, Nebraska, in 1882. He went to school there. He was part of a family. His father died when my father was eight, and his mother raised the eight children with the help of an extended family. He became a drummer, a traveling salesman, and traveled through the states adjoining Nebraska, Wyoming, Iowa. He had a strong sense of family. He had a strong sense of patriotism, and I have a letter that he had written to my Aunt Nell from a hotel in Iowa, and she passed it on to me. In part, it said, "The war is coming. We have no man in our family has served this country in a war. Surely we should do our part. I'm the only unmarried male in the family. I am taking advantage of my time on the road and have brought books with me. I'm studying. I hope to pass the officer's candidate test with high marks." And he did. He did. He entered the Army before the First World War began as a lieutenant. He went to France. He was part of General Pershing's staff.
So he went in. He ended up in Fort Huachuca. Eventually, you ended up in California. I know there's some good stories about what Colonel Campbell did in California after he had retired from the Army. Could you tell me a little bit about that period?
Yes, we retired to Covina, California. It was an orange-growing community, a mile square and all's there. Very, very similar people, very middle class, some lower middle class. People farmed, ranched. We bought 10 acres of oranges, and we had chickens, and we had rabbits. At that point, a retired colonel from the Army did not receive very much of a pension. So he dug his own ditches, irrigated his own orange trees. I have a remembrance then that has stuck with me, and it's only lately that I put these things together. The American Legion operated a swimming pool in Covina. We all swam there. It was very nice. But apparently there was one family in town who did not swim there. It was an African-American family, the Washingtons. My father felt that was wrong. And I was with him in the car as he circulated around his contacts, the car dealership, the filling station, the real estate office. And I can remember him saying, "You know, Ivan, it's not right. That boy should be able to swim there." And I heard it over again, "You know, Judd, it's not right. That boy should be able to swim there." And he was able to swim there. My father desegregated the Covina swimming pool so that the little Washington boy could swim there. Mm-hmm. I was embarrassed, frankly, to be going along on all these expeditions. I didn't want him to make waves, but my father never hesitated from making a wave.
If it was something he believed in.
If it was something he believed in.
You've talked a little bit about your father. I mean, one of the things that I'm really interested in is you've shared these stories with your children about what he did. And it's interesting for me to see what you then did in your generation. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about some of the stories that have been passed down. I know that right after college, you went to work in a settlement house in Chicago. And I was wondering if you could tell me why you went from California. You just graduated from UCLA and you went all the way out to Chicago. You know, what made you do something like that?
Well, I was very strong-minded. And I found that first daughters of strong-minded men frequently are at least as strong-minded as they. And we had our clashes over plenty of things. When I was at UCLA, it was known as the Little Red Schoolhouse. It was the time of the McCarthy hearings, and California had their own communist baiting hearings. So I liked my time at UCLA, and I lived in an interracial co-op. I was part of Students for Democratic Action. I really, and some of these were a little too far for my father, but I just told him, "You're the one that started it," and he recognized that. So I went to Chicago to work in a settlement house. I wanted some adventure, and Chicago seemed to be a good place to go. I stayed there and worked in the inner city in a settlement house for 3 years. It was a wonderful experience. And I met your father there.
And what did you do at the Settlement House?
I was the director of girls programming for a while, and then they promoted me to program director. And I hesitated about that because I really liked what I was doing, and I called my father, and he said, if they want to promote you, you've got to do it. You can do more for the people that you want to help when you get a little bit higher. He said, I was always happiest as a captain because I had enough power to make a difference, but I hadn't lost touch with the troops that I was there to care for. So he said, go ahead, get promoted. So I did, and I could see what he meant, that you can do more from a little higher up.
And you met my father. And what was he doing there?
He came after graduating from the seminary at Yale, came to spend a year working in an inner city parish. He came from the same kind of background, Kansas people who were very principled, very patriotic. And we didn't like each other much at first, but then we began to realize that we had started from the same place, and we decided we'd go on together.
And I know that one of the next steps after that was actually in Chicago, and you and Dad were called to an integrated church on the south side of Chicago in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about what that was like and what the congregation was like?
The congregation had been mostly Italian. It was third church, mostly Italian. It was on the very edge of the expanding medical center in Chicago. That church was just a conglomeration of professional people, people on welfare, people of other ethnic groups, other races, some highly educated people. I can remember during the riots following the assassination of Martin Luther King, when the whole area just north of us had gone up in flames, we had church as usual on Sunday, and our crew of people came out at the time that the National Guard trucks were driving past the church. They looked at us like we were from another planet, and we looked at them in the same way. It was a wonderful church group, a wonderful family.
And there's a story about Dad going out on that day. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, as I said, the real rioting and the burning was going about four blocks north of where we were, although I did see furniture being carried by our window, and we had calls from all over the country to see if we were all right. But your father disappeared for a while, and the next thing I knew, a black resident, one of our neighbors, pulled up in his pickup truck, and apparently he had been driving up there, and he saw my father just walking along in the middle of this.
Your father.
Well, a slip of the tongue that maybe means something. Saw your father walking along in the midst of all this upheaval, and he opened his door and said, boy, what you doing out here? You get in here. And so my father got in, and Bob McGee brought him back to relative safety.
Mm-hmm. And from Chicago, you moved on to Cincinnati, and Dad took another church there, which I think had a pretty big impact. That's the first church that I recall, and I think it had a pretty big impact on Kirsty and Allison and myself. Can you tell me a little bit about what this church was about and what it was trying to do?
This church was an experimental church with people gathered from other churches. We met in homes. In fact, you sat under the communion table, which was someone's dining room table, frequently. It was a group of people who had determined to get together to see what kind of changes they could do on institutions. These were all white people. They were all professional. They all had some area of power or expertise, and they wanted to use that for racial reconciliation, working on school desegregation, on institutional segregation. And at the end of 3 years, the agreement had been that they would go back to ordinary churches and be the leaven in the loaf to bring about more racial change, change in racial attitudes. It was very hard for these people to leave and to disperse. It took a year for them finally to decide that they could do more good back in the real world.
And from there, what did that lead to in Dad's work?
Well, he became and has been for the last 25 years, 30 years, the director of an interdenominational group in Cincinnati, the leaders of the Muslim, Jewish, Protestant, and Catholic judicatories have gathered together to work on social issues. It's had an impact in Cincinnati. Cincinnati is an unusual city. I feel it has a bad rap nationally. But it takes things seriously. And this group of judicatory leaders has had a real impact in not only racial issues, but openness. It's been a really once-in-a-lifetime kind of opportunity, perfect for your father, and he was perfect for it.
And at the same time that Dad was doing this, you went back to school. Can you tell me a little bit about what you were trying to do?
I went back to school to become a Montessori teacher. We lived in an integrated neighborhood. When we moved there in the 60s, people were moving out. There was a lot of block busting and panic peddling. But what was left was the people who wanted to be able to live together and the people who were moving in who wanted that same thing. It's been a wonderful place to live, always on the edge of falling apart. But it has been a good place to live. And I came back and had a preschool there that served 94 preschool children and their families. And again, the diversity was wide-ranging, from professionals, black and white, to people who were on welfare. It was a wonderful fulfillment for me.
And can you tell me a little bit about your philosophy in maintaining the student body?
I wanted it to be diverse. I wanted it to be people who cared for each other because they were there with their children. It was a perfect way to help them care for each other's children, and they did. I considered us a missionary effort, and we took 10% of our children came from wealthy suburbs surrounding, and there was always a line to get in because there's a hunger for among most people for something that crosses boundaries, that helps them relate to other people. And I firmly believe that there are a lot of people who are stuck far out in the suburbs who know that there is something lacking and who want to find it and certainly for their children to have it. You had it, Susanna. You were a minority in a school. By the time you were in the sixth grade, you were the only white girl.
Yes, it was an interesting experience. I think it was a very helpful experience.
Do you?
I do.
Because I have had moments of wondering whether it was right to expose children to something where they were so much in a minority.
Well, and I think there were difficult episodes. I mean, I've talked to you about some of those of being very left out of some things or being physically singled out in ways which were difficult. But you know, as you get older, I think one of the things that you realize is that to be able to decide whether you're going to be a minority or not is a privilege that many people don't have, and so it's not really something you should get hung up on being worried whether that was okay to do to your child. I think being in that position was very helpful because I did get some sense of what it felt like to be in a minority situation, where you're very self-conscious, where you're very aware of what you're doing and how it's interpreted and how you may be representing for a large number of people who aren't there. But I think it was a very, very powerful experience for me, a very important one.
Well, our conversation the other night made me realize that that is true. That is true. You have an empathy for the children that you work with now in your job, an empathy for children who might be left out, who are, may not be challenged. I was very impressed, Susanna. I felt as though I could see my father's values passed on and still in use. It was a very rewarding evening.
Well, and I think it's interesting because what I see is, I never really knew my grandfather, but what I see is your generation in this family and the things that you did, seeing what my father did, seeing the care that you took to make sure that this very high-quality school was accessible to children who couldn't pay the tuition, who might get shut out of that kind of quality educational experience, of looking at my Aunt Tish and my Uncle Leo, who were married back east, I think it was 7 years after the miscegenation laws were repealed.
You need to mention that Leo was African American.
Leo was African American, and closer out here in Flagstaff of my Uncle Wayne and Agnes, who's Navajo, marrying in Flagstaff only 3 years after the miscegenation laws had been repealed. And the kind of family that you all provided for my sisters and myself, it made some of the issues we've talked about very real. There, it's not theory. It's not, it would be nice if we, you know, could all live together. We all did live together. We had a family that included so many different kinds of people who are such incredible individuals all on their own. Marquita Lister, who was Leo's daughter, is a African-American opera singer, very well known. And my cousin Tamsin is a lawyer for the Navajo tribe. I mean, there are people that I think were given some of the strength to be trailblazers or push boundaries in our generation because of what we saw from your generation.
Which I saw from my father's generation.
Exactly.
I think that for my 74 years, I think the defining issue in this country has been the movement toward racial reconciliation. I think we have been very, very fortunate to be that intimately involved in that journey. I couldn't have asked for anything better for all of us than to be part of that.
So my question, we started out talking about your father, Colonel Campbell. And one of the questions that has crossed my mind is, in looking at this family, which is so different and includes so many different folks, what do you think he would think about that?
As I said, he was conservative. But I think the bottom line was that he respected people. And the values that he had were our family values, which is a label that is now being put on some values that I don't recognize. I think they're the family values that respect others, that try to do your best. Those are values that I don't recognize in some of the statements and the positions that are held by the family values people now.
So you think he'd be happy with what his descendants have done?
I think you would be very, very proud. Very, very proud. I think the applications of the values are different. But it's the fact that there are values that are held, deeply held, that continue to be acted on.
I don't know. Do I have anything else? Is there something else you would like to share?
I think we've covered it all,
Susanna.
I think
we came in and said what we wanted to say.
Up to this point, but yep. Who knows? We may have years and years and years more to go.
There's another generation out there in
yes.
Adam and Andrew and Hope, so we'll see.
And they're
stay
already,
tuned.
They are already
yes.
heading that way.
Stay tuned for episode 2. Yes.
What incidents did you have in your school? That's so interesting.
Well, I was very one of the few white children. There are a number of incidents. I mean, it was a situation in which, on top of that, I was a geek, so I really stuck out. I was called out to fight. I was smart enough not to do that. My older sister showed up and would get a whooping. And I learned not to show up. And, you know, valor is living to fight another day. But, I mean, there are a number. One of the ones that I think that was most difficult for me was actually just because it was so random, was a friend of mine and I were actually walking down across our field, our play field, to my mother's school where it was at that time for lunch. And it was my friend Ann and I, who was also white, and we walked past a group of African-American guys, and we got past them. And all of a sudden, I felt something on the back of my head, and they were throwing rocks at us. No particular reason, I mean, other than we were who we were. And I think that's what I learned to take out of it as I got older, was this, whatever kind of behavior was, you know, being shown to me, it really had very little to do with who I was as an individual.
Yes.
And it was, when I go back to my neighborhood, there are a lot of kids that I went to school with who didn't get out in one way, didn't go to college, didn't, you know, land a good job, and who I think in some ways knew that's where it was headed, even that early. And I think there was frustration at just knowing that the opportunities were not going to be the same. And so I think it sort of played out in picking on me. So those are some of the kinds of things.
And you said you get to choose to be a minority? What did you
mean? Well, it was a public school. And my mother could choose to put me in there, or could put me in a private school where I would have been, another adolescent white girl. But they were living what they believed, that this was important to have all kinds of people in the neighborhood school, that this was our neighborhood. It was an integrated neighborhood. And so going to the school there was important. It was what you did. And I think she's had some guilt because it was a difficult time, late 1960s, early 70s, to be in there. But it was, so it was a choice on her part. But it's also, it's a temporary thing, because I knew when I went in other situations outside of my school, I wasn't a minority. And so it was, there was an element of choice in being there, and that I don't think everybody has.
I think that part of it, too, was that you made some very deep friendships there, with both with white children, but with African-American children, with Lisa,
mm-hmm.
with Robbie. And when you were home last time, the fellow that lives behind us, I don't know, recognized you and was so glad to see you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it means when you've done that, you can go anywhere. You can be in any kind of group.
Well, I think you're more comfortable with the discomfort that comes of not being the majority. And I don't know that that's as common an occurrence as you would hope in 2006. That I think I had situations at my college. We had a racial incident, and we had one day devoted to a teach-in about racial relations. And I was actually working as a staff member at the college at that point. And I was sitting in a group of high-level administrators and undergraduate students. And the high-level we're talking deans, we're talking about how they grew up in Jim Crow South and had lived a very segregated life and had never had these kinds of opportunities to live with a lot of different cultures. And what was so disturbing to me was that the undergraduate students had all lived in very segregated situations. It was no longer by law, it was by practice that the communities that they lived in didn't really provide them the opportunity to mix with a lot of different people. And it was sort of at that moment when I was 22 that a lot of it really started to kick in, that what I had experienced in my neighborhood and my school was not what a lot of people experienced, and it was a bit depressing in some ways that we'd come through the 70s and the 80s, and we're into the 90s, and not much had changed since the 40s and the 50s.
So what have you learned, or how have you been shaped by your mom's choice?
Well, I think what she sees and what she's talked to me about is that I had the opportunity to be an outsider very early in my life. And what that did was make me very aware of bringing outsiders in. And one of the things that I do in my job, I work for Johns Hopkins, is creating summer residential academic programs for students who are about that age, or adolescents. And it's a residential experience, which means they're living with the same people that they're learning with. And it's an international program. So they're kids from all over the place. They give away millions of dollars worth of financial aid so that children from different socioeconomic backgrounds can come. And so when you put all of these kids together without parents around, it's really important to make sure that you create a community that helps them give to each other and care for each other. And in order to do that, you have to see how people might be excluded.
Do you remember the Hispanic man that was on the plane with you coming back from California a year or so ago at the end of one of your programs, and it had been written up in the newspapers? And he said, "What are you reading?" And Susanna said, "It's about my school." And he said, when she was finished, he said, "May I read it?" And this was a school in Southern California that was basically Hispanic, Mexican-American, and low income. But they had had the opportunity to participate in this program. And when I remember that you said when the man finished it, he folded the paper up and handed it back to you and said, "Thank you for what you're doing." And I think that's a tremendous...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for kids to get to meet each other and see that they've got an awful lot in common. And just having the opportunity, I think in some ways that is almost as important as what they learn in the classroom.
What do you think about your mom's choice way back then?
Oh, I'm fine with it. She still struggles with it.
Your choice, or why did you make that choice then, and what do you think about it?
Well, I think the bottom line, seeing how they've all turned out, it was the right choice to make. I think their lives are fuller. They are more confident of being able to go anywhere. They know who they are. I think the bottom line, it was the right choice. I think it was very hard to see her feeling frozen out. And the other two daughters, too. But they have all three of them are making a really exceptional contribution, not just through their jobs, but just through their relationships with other people, their philosophy, their political point of view. I think the bottom line is it was a good choice. It was a good choice. It was a choice that many children never have the opportunity to deal with. They never. I'm very fearful about the isolation of the suburban school systems. But that's another whole.
There are two just short vignettes that can kind of sum up my time at that school. And Roots came out while I was there. And there's this, I can't remember the line exactly, but it's basically they're telling each other how to avoid the slave catchers in Africa. And so it translates to something along the line that you can tell they're coming because white people smell like wet chickens or something like that. I don't know how many times I heard some variation on that about myself. And that was sort of the not so great side of things. But on the other side, I mean, one of my best images was at the beginning of all of our school gatherings or, you know, whenever we were together as a school, what you sang was "We Shall Overcome." And so it was this experience. I mean, that was just that I knew the words to that backwards and forwards and left and right by that time. And it's something that has stuck with me that I don't think a lot of schools were singing "We Shall Overcome" as their sort of their school cheer. So it's been good. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I guess I've carried with me, good and bad.
Did you have any memory of when you were like, I should pull them out of the school? Or was there a moment where it was so hard as a mom when you were watching?
I think there were probably several. But the alternative was to deprive them of something that I felt eventually would be of benefit. And one friend said to me once, their school isn't their whole life. It's a part of their whole life. And the rest of their life, our life as a family, as an extended family with all these different groups, I think was their main life. The school gave them a view into what life was like for some. And I think anything that helps you develop empathy with other people in the long run is good because you're a fuller person. There's another dimension to you than just what you know from your family, your same racial group, your same religious group. I think it leads to a far richer life with many more dimensions and aspects. I think it's a richer life. And I'm glad I've come to peace with that because there were times when I didn't like to have her called a geek. She wasn't a geek.
Yes, I was. But, I mean, it's interesting because, out of probably, I don't know, 100 or so in my sixth grade class, one of the schools in Cincinnati it's a public school, but it's a magnet school, and you test to get into it. And so they give the test to all of the sixth graders. And I can remember when I was notified that I'd been accepted. And it was literally they pulled about four or five kids out from the sixth grade rooms and told us. And it was, I don't think they actually said this, but I think it was communicated. You might not want to share this with everybody. But what I thought was so interesting was there were only four or five of us. And it was pretty split, balanced of African-American and white kids who would be going on to this school. And we went on to that school, and you were invited to come in based on your academics, your testing. But what was so interesting about the school when we got there was that it was a pretty balanced school. When Cincinnati went through desegregating the schools, which was actually brought by the family of my best friend, this whole case was brought by the Bronson family, and they came up with a formula for how to desegregate, and you had to have a representative number representative of the larger population of the city. And this was one of the few schools that didn't have to do anything, because it was based on not where you lived or how much money you had or anything like that. It was just, what do you as an individual bring to the table? And when you do that, it's representative. So
I guess my last question is, what has life taught you? If there's anything you wanted to pass on.
Mom.
No, that's you.
Age before beauty.
Are you asking me? what do I plan to do with the next few years?
No, what has life taught you?
What has life taught me? That it's beautiful. It's a privilege. I've been privileged that there's some cohesion to it. When you get to this point, you can see that this led to this, and this led to this, and this led to that, and there's a consistency through it. If you've been lucky, if you've been able to grow from the beginnings of a father and mother who felt this way, and marry someone who encourages that same thing, it's a growth. And I think I think it's been wonderful. Wonderful. And I just would like to have some more of it.
And I'm only 39, so I still don't know. I'm still figuring it out.
Susanna, I will keep my eye on you.
I know. I think that's what I've taken, is that you're not in it alone. I think I have always been pretty aware of my ancestors, and that this is all of a piece, and that it's good to know, but it's also a responsibility to pass along to the next generation.